make application of it in our lives. Tonight we're going to be on lesson 8, which begins with chapter 9, verses 1 through 14. Remember last time that we had our Hebrews class, we stopped with the end of chapter 8, with verse 13, in that he saith, "A new covenant he hath made, the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away." And we've done a lot of teaching about that. We've done a lot of teaching about the Old Testament law versus the New Testament law, when the Old Testament law was given, how long it lasted, what the purpose of it was, when it was done away with, whether or not we are still under the Old Testament law versus the New Testament. And so a lot of teaching has been done on that. And so, again, tonight will be chapter 9, beginning with verse 1. And this section, these first 14 verses, deal with the superiority of Christ's priesthood because of His service in a better tabernacle. And we didn't do this yet, right? You might have to remind me along the lines, but I think we stopped with the end of chapter 8, best that I can remember, which doesn't always go back very far. We're going to try to get through this chapter, which will be lessons 8 and 9 tonight. Tracy has the next lesson back there, and if we get to lesson 9, then we will hand those out so that you'll have them. Notice, if you will, it begins to say in verse 1, "Then verily the first covenant had also ordinances of divine service in a worldly sanctuary." Some of your versions are going to read different, depending on what version you use. I've got that on your handout, which is on page 1. Some versions may render worldly as earthly, as the New King James Version. How many versions, or what versions render it that way that you're using? I know some of you use different ones. New King James? Be earthly? Worldly? It's just talking about the physical tabernacle that was constructed under the Old Testament law that God gave to Moses and the pattern that God gave him for that tabernacle. Tell me the difference between the tabernacle and the temple. Were they set up the same way as far as what they contained and the purpose of them? What was the difference between the tabernacle or the tent of the congregation and the temple?
The temple had some more courts, courts of the Gentiles, that the Jews could go in.
Okay.
Through the Gentiles, and that, I guess, the courts would have been to the outside of that, carried outside of that tabernacle.
Okay. What do you think? What was really the basic difference between the tabernacle and the temple? It's kind of one of those things, if you're looking at the trees, you're going to miss the forest. What's the big difference?
Well, the temple was constructed out of stone and everything else, and that was just the basic elements.
That's right. Tents and so forth, and various skins that they made it out of. The tabernacle was constructed so that they could easily move it, right? When God gave Moses a pattern for the tabernacle, where were they at? They were at the wilderness, right? Wilderness wanderings. And so they had to be able to take it down as they were advancing toward the land of Canaan. And so it had to be constructed in such a way that they could easily take it down and set it back up. Well, obviously, the temple couldn't be that way. Who built the temple? Who planned the temple? Yeah, made provision for it. Here's a basic which is in your outline as well, but you may not be able to see it very well. You can read about it, Exodus 25 through 27, and how it was laid out. By the way, what direction did the children of Israel face? East, right? They were traveling east, kind of northeast, to the Promised Land. That's significant to think about that, as we're going to look at some scriptures from the book of Zechariah later tonight. But notice how it was said they had the courtyard, the altar of burnt offering, the laver, which was for what? Washing, right? Purification. And then they had the holy place, and then what? most holy, or the holiest of all, or the holy of holies, depending on what, again, what version you use. What was the difference between the holy place and the most holy place?
Yeah.
Only the high priest could go into the holiest of all. How often? What, for what purpose? Yeah, to make atonement for the children of Israel, right? By the way, that has everything to do with what we're studying from the book of Hebrews, because he's going to make a contrast. Now notice what he says again. Then verily the first covenant had also ordinances of divine service and a worldly sanctuary. For there was a tabernacle made, the first wherein was a candlestick and the table and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. And after the second veil, the tabernacle which is called the holiest of all. Again, you find statements like verse 5, "See, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern shown to thee in the mount." Would it have been acceptable if Moses would have digressed from the instruction that God gave? Every one of you know the answer to that. In fact, I think it was the first Bible study that we attended with you in 2013. CL did a Sunday morning Bible class on the pattern. He talked about this very concept, that they'll make all things according to the pattern. Sometimes we don't pay attention to the pattern, or we think that we can treat it loosely and change things, but even in the Old Testament, they had a pattern for worship, had a pattern for the tabernacle, had a pattern for the things that God would have them to do. Any comments about the tabernacle? Could be a good study in and of itself, but any other thoughts about that? Again, this is in your handouts. You can also see John 16, verse 2. We're not going to spend too much time on looking these up and reading them, because we want to try to get through the entire chapter. But divine service comes from the Greek word that is defined as meaning a ministration of God, or worship, ministering things toward God. And that's what the tabernacle was for. You know, they did a lot of things in the Old Testament, very briefly. They did a lot of things in the Old Testament the children of Israel did of a social nature. Tell me sometimes when you read about the children of Israel engaging in social activity. You ever read about that? Now, there were people like we are. They did things for entertainment and did things for pleasure, recreation. What did they do? Well, do you ever read about them being hospitable one to another and visiting with one another? You ever read about any of those kings that had banquets and various different gatherings for the people in their kingdom? The book of Daniel comes to mind. But yeah, how many times do you ever read that they did those things in the tabernacle? Do you? You ever remember reading about that? I don't either. You think that's significant as we look at types and antitypes? A distinction has always been made between what God's people did as individuals and what they did in worship to God. It's always been that way. Not that God has left the door open for us to do whatever we want to do that's pleasing to us, but to do things according to the way that He has instructed. Verses 2 through 7, statements made concerning the physical tabernacle. I want you to look on page, it'd be the back of page 1, actually page 2 of your handout, and drop down to the last slide. I just want us to read a couple of excerpts that I've got from a couple of sources that I thought was interesting regarding this. But these are made concerning the physical tabernacle. During the feast of the dedication of the temple, during the days of Solomon, it was said, "There was nothing in the ark save the two tables of stone which Moses put there at Horeb when the Lord made a covenant with the children of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt." Now, initially, what was in the Ark of the Covenant?
The manna.
The manna? Aaron's rod.
Aaron's rod.
And the tables of stone. Now again, this is not an inspired writing, but I thought it was interesting because I've often wondered at what point, if any, were those items, were they always there? Was there a point when those things had been removed? And of course, we'll probably never know the answer to that. It's also been said that the ark itself disappeared when the temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. What year was that? Destruction of Babylon. About. You see, we've been reading even in the book of Hebrews that it's inferred that even at this point, temple worship was still being observed by a lot of the Jews. About 586, right? 586 B.C. is when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Babylon. It was never restored after the Babylonian captivity, but instead there was a stone slab, 3 fingers in thickness, called by the rabbis, and I'm not even going to attempt that, which means stone of drinking or foundation. But the statements have been made concerning that. Could you imagine the glory of the temple, and then it's desecrated, destroyed, and if that be the case, that the Ark of the Covenant and the tables of stone were gone and so forth, that when the high priest went into the holiest of all, that all he was able to do was to see what used to be there. No longer able to know that those items were there. And again, we don't know if that's the case or not, but something to think about. Statements made again concerning the mercy seat was above the ark. The word from which mercy seat was taken from is a Greek word that has been defined as an atoning victim. Hebrews 2:17, the word merciful comes from a word that's rendered in other passages as merciful and reconciliation. Jesus is our propitiation. What does that mean, propitiation? Has to do with the Ark of the Covenant, the mercy seat, the cherubim. What's propitiation mean? We've talked about that. It actually means a covering. That Jesus was a covering for our sins. He made an atonement, redemption, reconciled, propitiation. And I've got the references there for you to look at. Verses 8 through 14. Neither by the blood of goats and calves, but by His own blood. Again, he contrasts between Christ and the high priest of the Old Testament. And we already looked at this in chapter 1, I believe chapter 3. But what were some of the differences between Christ being a high priest and the Old Testament high priest? What were some of the differences? Why is Christ superior to the Old Testament priesthood? Now, the Old Testament priest had to offer sins for himself and for the people. Jesus had no sins.
Sacrifice was able to do what the old sacrifice rules of goats could not do.
Yeah, that's right. They take away the sins of the people. And it was continual. Yeah. Well, remember, we talked about the fact that the Old Testament priest stood as they ministered in the temple. Christ is not standing in His ministration, but He's rather doing what?
Sitting.
His sacrificial offering is done. It's finished. It's sufficient. We'll look at it in the last half of chapter 9. Any other differences that you can think of that we've talked about?
Continual priesthood.
That's right. They were not able to continue by reason of death. But Jesus liveth forevermore, therefore He abideth a priest continually. Any other thoughts about that? A greater and more perfect tabernacle. This in reference to heaven where Jesus is seated on the right hand of God, and that's really in the next section that we'll talk about that more. Again, neither by the blood of goats and calves, but by His own blood. I want to ask you a question for thought. If you want to answer out, you can, but I still want you to think about it. And I'm not sure that I know I know I don't know the answer to my satisfaction in my own mind. Atonement for sin took place when? I mean, complete atonement. Not just an anticipation of atonement, but the atonement for the sins of the world happened when?
When Christ was sacrificed.
Yeah. When Jesus shed His blood, right? When He died. I agree with that too. Was there atonement made under the Old Testament law? Because there's always that remembrance made of their
that
sins.
Year, for that year, it would have been.
To me, that's a deep question for a number of reasons. In the Old Testament, I completely agree that without the shedding of blood, there could be no remission of sins. And Jesus clearly shed His blood for the remission of the sins of the world. He talked about that in Matthew 26:28. In the Old Testament, however, and it's not to say that this is the answer, but I just want you to think about this. God over and over and over told the children of Israel, if they offered this sacrifice or that sacrifice, He said, I will be merciful, I will forgive you of your sin. If you sacrifice this, I will forgive you. You have forgiveness. When the Bible says that they have forgiveness, did they have forgiveness? I just want you to think about that, because we're going to get to a statement that's made in just a moment that I think helps to answer that, or at least at best try to clarify it. And you'll read that position among brethren, both sides of the coin. And I've heard it both ways, that the atonement happened when Jesus died on the cross. I completely agree with that. And then the flip side of that is individuals would say, no, when God said that they had atonement for their sins and the atonement was made once a year by the Old Testament, the high priest, God forgave them of that sin. That's right. And we're going to look at that in this next section. But I want you to think about that, because when you have individuals that one day will ask you that question, well, yes, there was forgiveness under the Old Testament law. Because God said, I forgive you for what you did. If you offer this, we need to be able to have that somewhat ironed out in our minds to be able to give them an answer for that.
I think you might get to it. Leviticus 17:11 deals with that when it's talking about for the life and the blood. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you, and the altar to make atonement. So it was.
That's right. And even in that, and I believe wholeheartedly that God, yes, God forgave them. God said He would. That God forgave them, but yet there was something that the blood of bulls and goats could not do that was accomplished by the blood of Christ. And we're going to look at that in just a moment. But Jesus shed His blood for the sins of the world, not just for a select few, but for everyone. It's for the remission of sins. And again, accomplished something that the blood of animals cannot do. How much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered Himself without spot to God. Now notice the last part of this. Purge, what's the word purge mean? Paul sometimes used that word. Purge out therefore the old living, that you may be a new lump.
Cleansing.
Yeah, cleansing. What was some of the other ones?
Force out.
To take out of it or force out of it. So, notice what he says, who without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God. They could not have a pure conscience under the Old Testament law of Christ that we can have today as a result of the blood of Christ. Could they? We talked about it was a continual sacrifice made from year to year. The Bible also says, if you want to mark it down, I don't think that I put it in your handout, 1 Peter 3, notice how that's worded. 1 Peter 3, verse 21. The like figure whereunto even baptism doth also now save us. And then he puts in parentheses, and so this qualifies what he said. Not the putting away of the filth of the flesh. In other words, being baptized is not just so you can take a bath or get rid of the dirt on your flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God. And this is how, that that was accomplished by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We can serve God with a clean, pure conscience today, because we know that when He forgives us, He will not remember our iniquity anymore. He will not impute that toward us or count it against us anymore. There's not a remembrance made of those things. I've got 10 minutes. Someone starts saying
Romans 14:2. There, when they mention at the end of the chapter in Romans 14, Paul talks about there about doing things when you don't have a clear conscience. Or at least that's my understanding. You know, he asks in verse 22, "Do you have faith? Have it to yourself before God. Happy is he who does not condemn himself to what he approves. But he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because he does not eat from faith, for whatever is not from faith is sin." So if you don't have that, if you have that doubt or that question in your mind.
And how can we get rid of the doubt in our mind as to whether or not what we're doing is acceptable to God? That's right. Book, chapter, and verse. Go to the Word, right? He's told us what's right and wrong. So I shouldn't engage in something unless I know that it's right. I don't need to have the attitude, well, let me go ahead and do that, and then later I'll study and see if I was okay in doing it. Just don't do it until you know it's right. All right, chapter, or lesson 9, rather. And Greg has been kind of handing those out for us. Covers 15 through the rest of the chapter. And I know that's quick pace, but you have the information, you can go back and study. This one deals with the superiority of the new covenant based on the death of Christ. When we go back to chapter 2, that we studied why Jesus had to die. Why was it a necessity that he died? What were some of those reasons given? Or maybe you studied on your own. And why did he have to have a body and die?
One reason we're told that the testament of the testator is not in effect until death. We knew that his death had to come.
That's right. And that's blood. In this section. That's right.
Blood, you know, was the price for the sins of the world.
That's right. That he might be a faithful high priest, touched with the feeling of our infirmities, yet without sin.
Experiencing all that we've experienced.
That's right. That's right. Verses 15 through 17, for this cause his mediator, as Mark just pointed out, of the New Testament. I've got on the bottom of page 1 some definitions of the word testament and covenant. The King James Version uses the word covenant. The American Standard Version, the New King James Version, uses the word covenant as opposed to testament. I recently listened to a fellow talk about the book of Hebrews, and he made the statement that the word covenant is a better rendering of the word than testament is. But I think they're so close, it's just about hard to distinguish between the two. But understand that a covenant means what? We've covered this. What does it mean when God made a covenant with the house of Israel?
It means an agreement.
Yeah, an agreement. They agreed to do the things that God said. Remember, God spoke it to Moses. Moses rehearsed it in the ears of the people. And they said, all that God says for us to do, we will obey it.
God made the agreement.
That's right. He legislated what the terms were. And they broke that covenant. Wasn't that God broke it with them and destroyed them, scattered them on the face of the earth? But they broke the covenant. And as a result of that, God said, I'll make a new covenant with the house of Israel. Remember, we talked about that in Jeremiah chapter 31. for this cause. You know, notice in verse 15 he says, for this cause he is a mediator of the New Testament. What does he mean, for this cause? What cause? What cause is he talking about? How could Jesus be a mediator of a better testament? What was the cause of that? That's right. Why couldn't it take away sin? They're going right in that direction. That's right. Because his blood is superior to the blood of animals. And he talks about that in verse 14. How much more then shall the blood of Christ? And he says, verse 15, for this cause, he is a mediator of the New Testament. And then here's another kind of an explanation of that. And some have actually said this is a parenthetical statement. It's not in the King James Version, but that by means of death for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the First Testament, they which are called might receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. What's that verse teach us? Why can we use that verse for? When he says that by means of death for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the First Testament. What does that mean? That's right. You've heard the statement, his blood flowed backwards and forwards. That's a verse that you can use to prove that very point. He's saying that Jesus died. He's the mediator of the New Testament. That by means of his death, for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the First Testament. They committed transgressions under the First Testament. We've seen that all through the book of Hebrews. They failed to keep their end of the deal, the covenant. They transgressed and turned their back on God. And as a result of the death of Christ, they can have redemption. I think that helps answer, at least make more clear the question, what kind of forgiveness did they have under the Old Testament law? Because redemption came as a result of the death of Christ. Had Christ not died, could they have redemption? Could their sins been washed away by the shed blood of Christ? And there's other verses that we can look at, I think, in this section of the chapter that we'll talk about that. Zechariah, we've got 5 minutes. I'll try to get through the rest of this in 5 minutes. But there's a couple of prophecies that Zechariah made. Chapter 13, verse 1. Some of your margins may have had this, but I wrote it in my margin. I think it's a good note to have. Notice what he says. Zechariah 13, 1. In that day there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. We know what fountain was opened for the house of Judah, for the house of Israel, for the forgiveness of their sins. What was that? We sing about it. There's a fountain sometimes. What's that fountain? John penned about it in Revelation 22, verses 18 and, or verse 17 rather. Isn't not the gospel, the good news about Christ the Messiah and what he has to offer? Jesus told the woman at the well, if you drink of this water in this well, you'll thirst again. But if you drink of the water that I have, you will never thirst again. Remember that? Yeah. The fountain. Also notice Zechariah 14, verses 8 and 9. And it shall be in that day that living water shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea, and half of them toward the hinder sea. In summer and in winter shall it be. And I'll give you some thoughts that a man made about this, and you take it for what it is. It's just his thoughts, but I thought it was a good explanation of that. Earlier, I asked you what direction the children of Israel faced. And they faced what direction again? Someone read that does not use the King James Version, read that passage in Zechariah 14. Not all versions use the words the hinder sea.
And in that day it shall be that living water shall flow from Jerusalem, half of them toward the eastern sea and half of them toward the western sea. In both summer and winter it shall occur.
That's New King.
Okay. You see the difference in that? The western, the eastern, or the former and the hinder. Here they were facing the east, and he's saying it will flow the eastern direction and the western direction. Again, it goes back to what we just talked about in the book of Hebrews. The blood of Christ would cleanse both directions. I think that's a good explanation of that prophecy, and you can take that and study it for yourself. Notice the statement that qualifies the first part of verse 15. Time is gone, that by means of death for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first testament. Colossians 2:14, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. You're familiar with that. Verses 18 through 21, which will close out, or it ends with chapter, or verse 28 rather. The account of the dedication made with blood is recorded in Exodus 24, 3 through 8. Now, I tell you what, let's stop there instead of just leaving that hanging, not completing the next seven verses, because there's some really good, important statements that need to be made regarding the dedication of the things in the Old Testament versus the dedication of the heavenly things with a better sacrifice. Any questions or comments? Again, I know that that's speedy, but it's unavoidable. It's good to be back with you. I appreciate your good attention.